combustible fluids. And so this work is still work in progress, and I do this with my collaborators. One is my supervisor, Johanna Erdmenger, and one is a diploma student, Hans-Jörg Zeller. And so the first question I want to ask is, why are gauge gravity duality useful for hydrodynamics? And the first answer is, gauge gravity duality allows for simple calculation of real-time correlators. And this was basically done by Sonn and Steinitz and then by a lot more people. And from this real-time correlators, we know that the low-lying poles determine the hydrodynamic modes. And from there, we get the dispersion relations. So there's a way to calculate these hydrodynamic modes. And therefore, we can unambiguously construct the hydrodynamics of a system. And by using gauge gravity duality, we already discovered new transport coefficients in a system which has an anomaly. And this was basically done by these people here. And then the next question is why we want to study hydrodynamics of P-wave superfluids. The first thing is superfluids are in general interesting since they have a new hydrodynamic mode, the Goldstone bosons. And therefore, we get new excitations, second and fourth sound, and gauge gravity duality, they already looked at this phenomenon. And then P-wave superfluids, there's not so many things known about hydrodynamics so far in the gauge gravity duality. There's even more symmetries broken, so there's also rotational symmetry broken, spontaneously broken, and therefore we have new, more hydrodynamics mode. So there's a new, more Goldstone bosons there, and therefore we have new hydrodynamic modes. This should be interesting. And in general, phenomenologically, it's interesting to break these rotational symmetries because in condensed matter systems, they are often broken, like these liquid crystals or D-wave superconductors, where you always have a condensate which breaks rotational symmetry. So this is the reason why I want to study this P-wave superfluids. And here's now the outline. So the motivation, this is already over. Then the second point is I will construct these holographic P-wave superfluids as black holes with vector hairs. So this is done in these are my collaborators here, which I done this project. Then I will embed, so this is a gravity model, and I will embed this gravity model into string theory. And then we have the background. So this is basically the system, and then we look at the hydrodynamics of the system, and therefore we classify the fluctuations and then see how the fluctuations decouple. So this gives us the Green's functions. Then I look at two quantities so far. That's the conductivity and the shear viscosity, and at the end I will conclude. So first, a small introduction to gauge gravity duality. So I will use that type 2B supergravity on ADS5 times some compact five-dimensional space is dual to a conformal field theory at large NC and at large TOF coupling in the sense that the correlation functions agree. In addition, I will use black holes, which in the gravity side, which corresponds to the thermal field theories. And we will have gauge fields on the gravity side, which are then dual to the global currents. And this mu is a Lorentz index, and this A will be a flavor index. And that's following. And especially, we'll switch on time components of the gauge fields, and they induce a finite chemical potential and a finite density on the gravity, on the field theory side. Okay, so this is the starting point, and now there's the gravity model. So we start with a five-dimensional gravity model. So we have the usual Einstein-Hilbert term, we have a negative cosmological constant, and we have this kinetic term for the SO2 gauge field. And so if you write down the equation of motion for this action, you will see that only one parameter appears. So one free parameter, this is the ratio between these coupling constants, so the gravitational coupling and the Young-Mills coupling, and this we denote by alpha. This is the only free parameter which we have in the system. So we will study this at finite temperature and finite chemical potential, but also in addition to this, we want to look at the gauge field AX1, which is dual to this current. And because we want a superfluid condensate, we need something which breaks the U1 symmetry and which breaks the rotational symmetry, and this will be this current. So we have keep in mind that we also look at this gauge field. And why is this spontaneously, why is this then inducing a p-wave superfluid? So this wave of this current spontaneously break the remaining gauge theory, this U13, which is remaining from this SO2, because you switch on a time component in the three direction in flavor space. And this is remaining, and this is broken by this wave to a Z2. And in addition, because this is a vector X, SO3 is broken to SO2. And therefore, we have a p-wave superfluid. And the probe limit, so this is alpha to zero. This was studied by Gabser and Pufu 2008. But we will do more, so we do fully back-reacted calculations. So now first, let's see what is the interpretation of this alpha. From the holographic calculation of Weyl anomaly, we know that 1 over the Newton, or 1 of the gravitational coupling is proportional to the central charge of the CFT, and this central charge is basically the number of degrees of freedom. And then we can also do the same interpretation for the Young-Mills coupling. If you look at correlators of this SO2 currents, we see that they always depend on 1 over g square, and therefore 1 over g square counts the degrees of freedom which are charged under this SO2 symmetry. Yes?
From methodology here, since you just gave us Einstein, Young-Mills, are you assuming that practically any gravity theory you write down on ADS will correspond to some sort of
form? Yes. So this is at the moment what I'm doing is just I write down gravity. I assume that I have this SO2 symmetry, and then this is what I can write down if you only want two derivative terms, no higher derivatives.
So your statement is going to end up being something along the lines of if there is a conformal dual, this is what it will be like.
This is what it would be like, and this is the easiest thing I can write down. And later I will show you that we can embed this into string theory.
Okay.
So in a way, so this is what I will comment on this. Okay, and so if you have these two relations, then we can just put it together and we can determine this alpha. This is what's the free parameter in our system. This basically is then the number of charge degrees of freedom divided by the number of total degrees of freedom. So we now have an interpretation what this alpha means on the field theory side. So we are good to go, and we understand now our model. The problem is if there is really this field theory side in the dual, because we don't have the string theory interpretation of the monodons. But if there is something, this must be it. Okay, now let's look at the gravity side at finite temperature and finite chemical potential. And there we know the solution analytically. It's this ADS Reisenstein black hole, which is given here. So there's this metric. Here there's this black hole. There's this Blackman function, which I wrote down here. This is the mass of the black hole. This is the charge of the black hole. This is the normal Reisenstein form. In addition, we have the time component of the sketch field. And there we have the chemical potential and the charge. And here again, this flavor direction 3 is just a gauge choice. But now if you look at this fluctuation of this another gauge field, which gives us the order parameter on the field theory side, we see that there's an instability in this Reisenstein. So there's here on this axis is the coupling constant alpha, and here it's temperature over chemical potential. And we find this instability by looking at quasi-normal modes of this field, and then we see that they cross in the origin, and there we see that there's an instability, and we can really map this out. So there's some unstable behavior, and if you have this unstable behavior, then normally you say that this mode should condense, and then we have this superfluid. So what is this condensation progress? So if you write down this action for this field, then we get just a kinetic term, and something which looks like a mass term. And so we have some metric factors, and we have this gauge field, the time component of the gauge field. And so if you sketch what this function looks like in the bulk, so this is now the radial direction in ADS. So there's the horizon here, there's the boundary. And you see this effective mass gets somehow negative, and it can really go down really deep into negative, and so therefore it's clear that it can be unstable. And therefore, we find this instability, and then we have the condensation of the vector here. But why is this stable? So because we hear about no real theory. So what is the problem here? So see at this picture. So we have a horizon, which is charged. Then we have this condensate, which should be in the bulk. This is also charged. That's the same charge as the horizon, so it's pushed. This is pushed away by the electric field. But also it has some energy, and therefore it's attracted by the black hole. And in ADS space, this can equalize it, and so we can really have an equilibrium in ADS space. So we will have a condensate which is over the horizon. Okay, now this was some words, so now we'll take
another question. So since there's a time component, does this break Lorentz?
Yes. So we first break Lorentz symmetry, but this is already broken if you have temperature. Yeah. So because of the temperature and the chemical
but I mean like local Lorentz symmetry. So
we have some medium there, so then it's always broken. If you define a temperature, you break the
Sure, and the thermal gas, but I'm talking about the black hole. So if you take like a black hole in the Lorentz violating gravity theory, you'll typically find that it has multiple horizons and that sort of thing. Is this one of those situations? Or is the local Lorentz symmetry of the
I'm not exactly sure that I understand.
So it's not one of those situations?
Not one of those situations. Everything still propagates on a wide count.
Yeah.
Okay. That's all.
Okay. So now, to the calculation, we will see that it's a stable solution. So we will solve the Einstein-Wilds equation numerically, and this is our answer we will take. So there's the metric here. This is the general form for an SO2 invariant metric. We only have SO2 invariant because we break it by the vector. So there's the SO2 part here. And we have the gauge field where we have the time component and this x component, which will be the order parameter. And so if you plug this ansatz into the equation of motion and then put it into Mathematica and do some shooting method, you get the solutions here. And so we will have, so this is the time component of the gauge field. It has a general form. So this is the ADS radius again here on this axis. Here's the horizon, there's the boundary. So we will have zero at the horizon, and then it becomes non-zero, and we can think of the chemical potential, which is here, and the subleading term is the charge. There's this green line, but you see that's the green line here. This is the W, so it's non-zero at the horizon and close to zero at the boundary. So it's zero at the boundary. This means that we don't switch on a source for this operator. That's the reason why it's spontaneously broken. And the subleading term gives us the ref of the current. So this is the order parameter. And this black line is the mass. So at this point, we can just read off the mass. And on this side, I plot this F and sigma, which are here in the metric coefficients. And F is important because F gives us the breaking of the SO3 symmetry. So if F is 1, we have an SO3 invariant theory, like here in the boundary, there F is 1. And if we approach the horizon, we see F is non-equal 1, and so we have a breaking of this SO2, and of the SO3 to SO2. And therefore, we also see that this SO3 is spontaneously broken. Okay, now we can read off the order parameter. So this is this JX1, this is some dimensional ratio. And here's the temperature over the critical temperature. And now we can choose different values of this coupling constant and see how this order parameter behaves. So for small values of alpha, this green and this blue line, we first see that if we decrease the temperature, it's zero. And then it monotonically increases here. And so since it's monotonically, this signals that it's a second order phase transition. And we can read off the critical exponent by fitting to this value here. And then we see that 1/2 is the critical value, the critical exponent for this field theory. So we always have mean field theories, mean field behavior. And if we go to larger alphas, we see that there's a multivalued region in here for this order parameter. And this is what is normally known for first order phase transitions. So that's the new thing is that we have this first order phase transition if the coupling constants are big enough. Okay, now this let's do this more precise. Look at the thermodynamics of the system. So first, we look at the small coupling constants. There's a grand potential and the entropy. So this is the dimensionless ratio of the grand potential. And there's, again, the temperature divided by the critical one. This is the entropy, and this is the temperature. So we see that the grand potential smoothly goes. So the blue one is the normal phase, and the red one is the superfluid phase. So it goes smoothly through the superfluid phase. And the entropy is continuous but has some kinks. So this is a second-order phase transition. Now if we go to higher alphas, you see that there's the swallowtail behavior, and so there's the preferred phases are this blue line here and this red line here, and so there's it's continuous, the grand potential is continuous, but it already has a kink, and the entropy has a jump. So it jumps from here to here, and therefore we have a first order phase transition. And this is for every alpha which are bigger than this critical value. And now if you look at some phase diagram, so we plot here the coupling constants and here temperature mu. This blue line you already saw, this is the unstable region. And this is now the second order phase transition from a normal fluid to the superfluid. There's this critical value here, and there's this metastable rising hot stream black hole phase where the transition from here, from the normal phase to the superfluid phase is first order. So this is now the new thing which we found in the system. And here are the values. So this critical value is here. And for coupling constant larger, this value, there's no superfluid phase. OK, are there any questions to the system? Then otherwise, I will come to the string theory embedding. OK, let's do now the string theory embedding. So we can embed this gravity model into the 3D7 brain setup. And we know that this D3D7 brain setup is dual to n equals 4 super Young-Mill theory, which is coupled to n equals 2 hypermultiplets. And to do this, we need coincident D7 brains, which then, because they are coincident, so we need two of them. They provide this SO2 or U2 non-abelian gauge fields. And this will give us a global flavor symmetry on the field theory side. And therefore, we have basically the same structure. So, but there's a problem. So we have to handle this non-abelian DBI action. And the problem is that the action is not known. It's only known to alpha prime to the fourth order. And then it looks like this. So there's this field E, which is metric, and B field. The phi, this is the transverse scalar of the brain. And there's the gauge field, which lives on the brain. So this is the form. And the problem is how to order now the gauge indices in this action. And there, the best guess at the moment is this symmetrized trace prescription, but this is probably not the correct answer. So we know that it's only correct to alpha prime to the fourth. So now how we can handle this, let's go through. So we see that if we have the D3 brains, the B field is zero. So we can neglect this. Then we can use the symmetries of our setup. So we set the one transverse scalar to zero. So all the commutators in the phi are zero. So Q is one. And so so we get rid of these terms. So now it's almost looking as a abelian DBI action. So there's only this pullback of this metric factors here. But if we write this pullback down, it looks like this. And since this transverse scalars are in the adjoint of the gauge field, get this commutator terms here, which are still a problem, so which looks like a problem. But now we can use more symmetries, and we can just choose that the transverse scalar is in the zero flavor space direction, and then this gets rid of all the commutator terms, and we have something that looks like an abelian action. Okay. So now there's still this problem with the symmetrized trace. So how we get rid of this? So we have two different approaches. The first one is we expand the action to fourth order. So the good thing is that we include maximal number of terms we can trust. There we are sure that these are all terms and they are all correct. The problem is it breaks down if we are deep in the superfluid phase, so we cannot trust this approximation. The second one is we used some adapted symmetrized phase prescription in the way that we set all the sigma matrices square inside the symmetric phase to one. It doesn't look like an approximation, but it is one inside the symmetric phase. And if we do this, the good thing is that we can handle all the terms, so we can really sum up the square root afterwards. But it's strictly valid only if we have infinite number of flavors, and there's a problem with this, with the proper approximation. But at the end, if we compare these two approaches, it gave the same physics. And now how to see it, that it's really containing the gravity model. So we have the D3 brains. They are determined by type 2b supergravity, and type 2b supergravity has a term, have of course an Einstein-Hilbert term, and that a coupling constant now is nc square. And we had this dBi action, which is now here, and if you expand it to alpha prime to the fourth, we get this kinetic term for the gauge fields, and the coupling constant now is here. So we see that we really have the same terms, but there are much more terms, so the calculation is much harder. But we did it in the paper, and you can see the answer there. And now one comment is that if you have this alpha, you can now read off as NF over NC. And this is basically what we had before. So this is the charge decrease on freedom, so the flavor decrease of freedom, they are charged on this SO2. And these are the color decrease of freedom, the not charged on the SO2. So this is, so we had the right impression from what we had before for alpha. And in this case, in the D3D7 system, at the moment we can only handle alpha equal to zero, so there's no back reaction of the gauge fields. Okay, now let's come to the hydrodynamics. So the problem is now with the hydrodynamics, we need the back reaction of the gauge fields to the metric, otherwise the energy momentum tensor would be trivial and there would be nothing interesting. So therefore, we look just at the gravity model so far, because there we can control back reaction, and there we should see some effect in the energy momentum tensor. But first, look at what is hydrodynamics. So it's an effective theory of slowly varying perturbations, so that the frequency and momentum are small, and the equation of motion are just the conservation laws of the energy momentum tensor and of the current, of the conserved current. And then we get, in addition, we get constitutive equations which depend. So where we get the dependence of this energy momentum tensor and the current on, for example, the velocity of the fluid. And if you write this constitutive equations, this defines transport coefficient as viscosities. And if you have a microscopic theory, then we can determine this coefficients. Okay, now to get this hydrodynamic prescription, we need fluctuations around our background, because these fluctuations, then from there we can read out the hydrodynamics. So we set now the metric given here. So there's a background metric, and there are some fluctuations which have some frequency and momentum in x direction and in y direction. So we need two momentums, because we broke the SO3 symmetry, and we have the gauge field here, which is the background gauge field plus some fluctuation. And by gauge fix, and we can gauge fix this, and then we see that the R components of these fluctuations must be zero. And now we can classify the fluctuations. So if we switch on a momentum transverse to our condensate, there's no symmetry left. So we break the SO2 symmetry, and then there's only a Z2 symmetry. And then the problem is that all the fluctuations couple. So we get 10 fluctuations from 10 dynamical fluctuations from the metric and 12 from the gauge field. And there's an addition 5 constraints on the metric and 3 constraints in the background. So we get in total 14 physical modes. And this is at the moment what we didn't do. So this is very complicated, and we had no results yet. But we can look at the other case, where we only switch on a longitudinal momentum, so a momentum in the x direction. Or if we switch on no momentum, then we still have an SO2 rotational symmetry left. And then we can do a classification. So there are some helicity two states. These are these two, and they are two physical ones. We have helicity one states, which are given here. And there's the same as the set coordinate, so we get 4 times 2 physical states, and there's helicity null, 0 states, which are here, and there are in addition 4 physical modes. There's also in total, there are 14 physical modes. So now we can do some calculation. So this helicity 2 states, these are what I call trivial, so this is what was known before, and they will give us the shear viscosity, and that the shear viscosity divided by the entropy will be 1 over 4 pi. And so I will look at these helicity 1 states here. They are mu, and they will give us the conductivity in the system and an additional shear mode. And also the helicity 0 states, we don't have yet some results. So are there questions so far? Okay, and let's review this helicity 2 state. So if you write down this helicity 2 state and look at the action, then we see that it's just a minimal coupled scalar in this background. Then the viscosity is then defined by this pi, and where pi is the conjugated momentum to this field phi, so it's defined by this ratio. This is basically done if you use the recipe by Son and Steinitz, and then the Kubo formula, you get this ratio here. And now if you write down the equations of motion for these two fields, if omega is very small, you see that they are trivial. So there's no profile in the bulk, and you can just read off this ratio here wherever you want. And we know some condition at the horizon. So at the horizon, these fluctuations must all go into the black hole because we want retarded correlation functions. So it must be nothing can come out of the black hole, but everything goes into the black hole. So this stuff gives us the condition. And then if we fix this condition, we get eta over s, which is 1 over 4 pi. And this is so far true for all two derivative series. If you want to break this in a gravity setup, you have to use higher derivative terms like higher curvature corrections, and I don't want to comment on this because the experts are here. So, and now if you look at this helicity 1 state at zero momentum, then we get at zero momentum they can decouple into two blocks. So we have 4 physical modes, and they couple into blocks. There's one physical mode in the first block and 3 physical modes in the second block. And so this is just a favor to, I just wrote this equation down to give you a favor how this looks like. So the small a's and h, these are the fluctuations, and the n, sigma, f, w, and phi, these are background fields which we know numerically. And now we have to solve this system numerically. So first we can see what are the correlation functions which we can get in the system. So if you look at the first block, there's this field ATY and AY3. So this is dual to the energy momentum tensor, which has a TY component, and this field is dual to a current J3Y. So we get, and since they are coupled, we get this matrix correlation function. And in the second block, we have 3 modes. So we get the energy momentum function XY, and we have this current correlation function also. So there's a 3x3 matrix in this correlation function. But now I just want to look at the conductivity, which is given by this correlation function here, and by a shear viscosity, which is given by this correlation function. Okay, first, the electric conductivity. So the electric, this is the Kubo relation. So it's the correlation function here for this current. And then you multiply it by I and divide it by omega. Then you get the electric conductivity. And now we do the numerics, and then we get these two plots. So there's the real part of the conductivity is here over the frequency. And then we have the imaginary part of the conductivity over the frequency. And if you look at this, you get the normal result, which is known for charged superfluids or superconductors. There's a gap in the real part of the conductivity. And then you also get this pole, this 1 over omega pole in the imaginary part of the conductivity. And if you can relate this 1 over omega pole by the Gramers-Kronig relation to a delta pole, which is here at the real part of the electric conductivity. And so you get the usual behavior that the DC conductivity is infinite, which is this delta function, and then you have a gap here in the spectrum, so there's an energy gap, and this is known what is known for superconductors or charged superfluids. So this is why these systems are called holographic superfluids or superconductors. This is zero momentum, and this is the conductivity transverse to the condensation. And now let's come to viscosities. So since we break the symmetry, the viscosity is a bit more difficult, so it's now a tensor. So let's review how this works. So viscosity in general refers to dissipation of energy by due to internal motions, and there's this dissipation part of the energy momentum tensor, and we can write down this symmetrized version of the gradients of this velocity fields. And so the relation then, so the linear part is then given by this viscosity, which is for a rank 4 tensor in general, for general fluids. And from the so if you look at the symmetries here, you see that you can switch the first two, the second two, and then the first two and the third and the fourth indices. So they are the symmetries, and then you can count, you have 21 independent components. And this viscosity is, I mean, shear and bulk at the moment.
Okay.
So there's everything in there. So there are 21, and now we can just look at isotropic fluids. And then if you have the symmetries, like this SO3 symmetry, you can reduce this rank 4 tensors, and then you get just two independent components. This is the sigma, which is the bulk viscosity, and eta, which is the shear viscosity. And if you do this, if you choose them like this, you get the usual result for the stress tensor. There you have. This is the symmetric traceless part, and this is the trace part. So this is the bulk, and this is the shear viscosity. But now we don't have this symmetry anymore, so we have a viscosity in a transversely isotropic fluid. So we have some field pointing in one direction, and then around this field we have the symmetry. So we have just we broke SO3 to SO2. So we have looks something like this. And there, if you reduce this rank 4 tensors, you get 5 independent components. And this is, you can write them down like this. So there are 2 bulk viscosities, this sigma x and sigma y. Then there are 2 shear viscosity, this eta yz and this eta xy. So there are 2, and there's a new parameter lambda there which couples, which is also there. So this is a new transport coefficient which shows up. And now if you look at the non-diagonal elements of the stress energy tensor, you get this relation. So you see that there's only the shear viscosity there, and this is the usual one that you have the symmetrized version of this gradient here. So then you get, the important thing is now that we have 2 shear viscosities. So one which goes with xy, which we had before in this helicity 1 fluctuation, and one is this YZ, which we had, which was this helicity 2 field. We already calculated that this Y over Z divided by the entropy density is 1 over 4 pi, but now we can also look at this eta XY. So this is now the Kubo formulas. So this XY is now given by the correlation function of the stress energy tensor xy, and we have to take this limit here, and also this yz, which is basically the same, it's just the indices different. And so if you do now the numerics, you get this result. So the Y set, this is because it's a helicity 2 state. So we plot here the 4 pi entropy over density and here temperature over the critical temperature. We see that this is the universal value. It's just 1 because it was this helicity 2 state. And this now can deviate because it's the helicity 1 state. And so it couples to all the gauge fields there. And it's therefore, it's not universal anymore. And we see that it goes up. And this is now some picture if the coupling constant is smaller than the critical value. If you go to upper values, you just see a first order transition. So you get this swallowtail behavior again to this multi-value region. No, it's at the moment what we saw.
So we have not completely scanned through all the values, but at the moment we see that it always goes up.
But you cannot prove it that it's always.
No, it's just numerical what we can do. So at the moment I cannot prove it, but I will look at it. Maybe I will find something. But the problem is, though, there's a lot of couplings there.
So it's clear that it can deviate, but it's not clear if it goes up or down. But at the moment, I will just say that it's not universal anymore, but the bound is still valid.
Perturbatively for small values of alpha. The leading order in T is that if it's linearized in alpha, that by simply changing the sign of alpha, it can be. That's an important question because the questions are what happens with the viscosity at the phase transition, whether some people want to say that it achieves a minimum at the phase transition for the shear viscosity. It looks like that indeed, in your case, it appears that it's a minimum value. So
the problem, if you look at the equations, then the problem is there are always only alpha square terms. So if you cannot do really expansion.
Well, we will be linear in alpha square. You're saying that it will come with some distinct sign, and it will probably the sign be that perturbatively it will always go up. But we can help.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if you can solve the background perturbatively function. I know you can solve it. So there's. So you can determine this point alpha equals 0. At this point, you know what it is. This is the only point. So this is at 0 alpha, the critical temperature. This is what you know. So this, there are some calculations which lie directly on the line for alpha equals 0.
And where are you computing the other shear viscosity at which point on this plot?
It's
over here.
So it's very far away.
Yeah.
If you have alpha equals 0, then you don't have data.
Okay.
But can you? What I thought what you were talking about is perturb around alpha equals alpha c, where the condensate is small. Can you expand and somehow a small condensate?
The problem is you don't know this point analytically. And you always have to know the point where you start the perturbation analytically. So we tried a lot to do some analytics.
Presumably because the phase exists only for alpha less than alpha critical. It will not be a linear in alpha minus alpha critical.
No, this point is just known numerically. So it's.
But it is known numerically, but then you know that it is a non-analytic point because the phase just doesn't exist. You know, and that shear viscosity just stops hard at alpha sub c. So for alpha larger than alpha sub c, you just don't have that phase anymore. You have sort of only the normal or the universal shear viscosity for alpha larger than alpha.
No, there's also, there are both. Yeah. So, but if you have the superfluid phase, if you have the superfluid phase and you have the back reaction, then you have both shear viscosity and one is non-universal. So if you are in this blue or this red region, then you have one because you break the symmetry, there you already break the symmetry to SO2. Mm-hmm. And then you have two shear viscosity, one is universal, one is not universal.
So where does the non-universal one stops at alpha sub C if you
So you go in this direction? Or?
Yeah, why it doesn't exist at small values of alpha?
At alpha equals zero, it doesn't exist because you don't break the symmetry. You don't break SO3 to SO2 because the
right.
Superfluid
so
doesn't exactly break
it.
So it's still SO3 invariant. And in the normal phase, so in this region, you also don't have to break in from SO3 to SO2. But if you only have one shear viscosity, which is universal.
Yeah, well, okay, so that's all that's. Question on the previous transparency. So these computations that you do, so there is no mixings in those channels with bulk viscosity. So those are just pure shear viscosity.
Just pure shear viscosity. So you see it from here because this is basically
viscosity. Okay. Yeah.
And the bulk viscosity there, I'm not sure if this is everything. So if you look at the trace of this, you get. If you just use this one, you just get these two bulk viscosities. Mm-hmm. But there, so if you look at Landau-Lifshitz and superfluids, there you also see that the Goldstone bosons should appear in this space. But they should not appear on the non-diagonal. So these are the only terms we get here. But we expect more terms in this thing. So the problem is not to calculate this lambda, so this is much harder to do. Because there you get all the couplings to this Goldstone boson. Mm-hmm. Okay, now let's come to the summary. So the first thing I showed you that we can realize this holographic p-wave superfluids by black holes is a vector here. Then and there we see that the order of the transition depends on the number of charge degrees of freedom. And then I showed you this spin theory embedding of this model, which is this VD7 brain setup. And at the end, the newest result is that we have this non-universal behavior of the shear viscosity. And I think this is so. What I know is this is the first non-universal behavior of the shear viscosity in an Einstein gravity theory, which I mean that you only have two derivative terms. At the moment, it was always, so everybody said if you have two derivatives in your action, then you always get 1 over 4 pi. And the reason why we don't have it here, why we have this non-universal behavior, is that we break the rotational symmetry. This is the outcome. And now, the outlook. So although I'm at the moment just talking about superfluids, but this holographic superfluids, they should be very, the superfluids are very similar to superconductors. So if you just gauge the global symmetry which you break spontaneously, then you get a superconductor. And since they are all strongly coupled, it's expected that this non-conventional superconductors which appear close to its quantum critical points and which still have a problem which are not described by DCS theory and which are not, which condensed matter physicists cannot describe. So also this system may sheet light into this business, but at the moment I'm just concentrating on superfluids, and the next point is just analyze all the transport coefficients which are in the systems. So we saw there's this, the bulk viscosities, they are zero because we have conformal fluid, but we have we already saw it's lambda appearing. This is a new transport coefficients, and there will be much more transport coefficients if you go to the scalar sector. So So there will be orders. Just the second and fourth sound, the speed of sound will be depend on the direction and all these things, and this is what we want to do next. So thank you for your attention.
Sorry, just a question about the general setup. So generally, I would expect for P waves, like you get an order parameter, like in condensed matter, you would describe P waves with two order parameters,
yeah.
two scalar order parameters, and in this case, it sounds like they're being described by vectors.
Yeah.
And so I'm unfamiliar with the non-abelian nature of ADS-CFT. So do you have?
So it's different in normally in condensed matter system. If they talk about P wave superconductors, there you have the internal symmetry, and then you get you don't have vectors condensing. You have something like the orbital form, the P wave orbital, which is then there and breaks the symmetry. In this case, we really have a vector which points in one direction, and it's then condensing. And what our interpretation is, so if you look at these D3, D7 systems, then you know that the modes which condense, they are Rho mesons. And these Rho mesons, they are spin 1 mesons. And so they have a vector, the spin, and then it's just that the spin pointing in one direction, and this breaks the symmetry. And there are some systems in condensed matter systems which behave similar to these spiral magnets. So something like this. So you have some spin, and then this, if you go from one point to another, this looks like this. And if you see that this produces your current in one direction. So these are spiral magnets. And we think that we have something like this.
Okay, if there are no further questions, let's thank Pat. Mm-hmm.